Ladies and gentlemen, my talk is called Aspects of Sufism. And I have spoken, I will probably repeat many things I have said before, but what I would like to begin with is to tell you that I won't speak, for those of you who are Muslim, I won't speak of the Holy Quran. When I speak, I will speak simply of the Quran as we do in English. We don't say normally the Holy Bible, Christians, we say the Bible. So I will say the Holy Quran. And when I speak of the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, I will say now, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, for the whole talk, because in English we don't interrupt talks with the Arabic formula and that. So you will excuse me, and I feel that he, alayhi salatu wasalam, will excuse me also if I don't repeat every time these words. Now, the Quran, and this is not generally known, unfortunately most Muslims today, at any rate, are very ignorant of the Quran. They only know certain verses which they use, many people, and this is increasing, and they are unaware of many passages in the Quran. Now, the Quran says very clearly, to every people we have sent a messenger. Some of them we have mentioned, others we have not mentioned. Now, people, to every people, the word people may mean a whole continent, or it may be a much smaller area. But if we look at the world as it is today, we see immediately what religions have been sent by God. That is, we see what are the great religions of the world. There's no need, in fact, for me to mention their names. We see also the remains of older religions, which also clearly came from God, but when they had to be replaced by other religions. Because what God gives to man, man eventually destroys. The religions of India, that is Hinduism, of Greece and Rome, were originally sister religions. They all clearly came from God. Only one of those three religions remains today, that is Hinduism. The religions of Greece and Rome were eventually destroyed and corrupted by man. They had to be replaced by other religions. But Hinduism remains. It has retained its truth. And now, there is a passage in the Quran which is not generally known. And it is a Medina verse. It is not an early verse in the Quran. Some people like to think that it has been abrogated because it doesn't fit in with the modern Islamic ideas. But nonetheless, it is clearly not, the Quran is just taking the advantage. It's a later revelation revealed in Medina towards the end of the Prophet's life. And the Quran here takes the advantage of speaking not only to Muslims, but to the whole world. And the words are this: for each of you we have made a law and traced out a path. And if God had wished, he would have made you one people. The next verse is a little elliptical, but we did what we did in order that we might put you to a test. That is a fair test in what we had given you. That is, if we had given only one religion, it would not have been a fair test, because that religion would have suited some people better than others. So we gave you many religions. As to the differences between religions, the Quran goes on to say, vie with each other, that is, you members of different religions, vie with each other in good works. Unto him, that is to us, the Quran often speaks, God speaks in the first person and then in the third person sometimes of himself. Unto him you will be brought back, and he will explain to you the differences between you. That is, we do not need to worry, the vast majority of people don't need to worry about the differences between different religions, because God promises that when we return to him, he will explain to us the differences between Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on. I was once asked a question, an intelligent question, by a Muslim lady: did I think that the Buddha was one of these messengers whom God sent to a people, and who is the Buddha one of those who are not mentioned in the Quran? And I said, without a doubt, yes, because the Buddha founded a world religion which has remained for over 2,000 years and which is still alive, and only a divine messenger could do that. God would not have allowed any pseudo messenger, pseudo prophet, to found a world religion like that. This is just by the way. But let us illustrate what this verse of the Quran tells us, that by a large circle, and let the different religions, that is, the sent by different messengers to all the people on earth, let them be represented by a point on the circumference of the circle. Now, from every point, there is a radius moving to the center. The center is God himself. The answer to the question, what is Sufism, is that Sufism is the radius which leads from the point on the circumference, which is Islam, to the center. That is precisely what Sufism is. And from every point on the circumference, there is, I repeat, a radius leading to the centre, and as they approach the centre, the radii become nearer and nearer to each other. On the circumference, there is some distance between the point where Christianity starts, the point where Islam starts, the point where Hinduism starts, the point where Judaism starts. But as the radii approach, and each radius represents the inner aspect, what's sometimes called the mystical aspect, the mysticism in question, of its religion. And as they approach the center, the radii become nearer and nearer to each other. That is, every religion in its mysticism is near, relatively near, to the other religions. And that is why in India, the Sufis, throughout the centuries, have lived in harmonious, good relationship with their Hindu equivalents. In many parts of India, Sufi orders and the corresponding Hindu orders have been in communication with each other. It has even happened that in the past that Hindus, when their guru died, have noticed that the Muslim sheikh who is guiding the Sufis in a nearby village is more spiritual than their own guru's successor. And it has been known that they have come to the sheikh, that the Sufi sheikh, and asked him to be their guide while remaining Hindus. And the Sufi sheikh has agreed to do that. And the opposite has happened, that Sufis have sometimes come under the guidance of a Hindu guru when they felt that he was the most spiritual man they could make contact with. Now, in the beginning, Sufism had no name. It is often said that Sufism had no name. Ibn Khaldun, the historian, a famous Muslim historian in the Middle Ages, said that at first spirituality was too general to have a special name. But when worldliness spread, then a special name was necessary. And the inner aspect of Islam came to be called Sufism. But already in the 10th century, many Sufis felt that Sufism itself was degenerating to a certain extent. It is not the same as it was. One in the 10th century, that is the 10th century AD, I use the Christian dating when I'm going to give a date here. In the 10th century, a great Sufi said, "Today, Sufism is a name without a reality. In the beginning, it was a reality without a name." But then Hujwiri in the 11th century commented on this, saying, "In the time of the companions of the Prophet, the name did not exist, the name Sufism did not exist, but the reality was in everybody. Now the name exists without the reality." Well, that is clearly an exaggeration, but nonetheless, one could say also that in fact there was a name, and that name was Islam. That was the first name of Sufism. At its beginning, Islam was the highly rigorous path of doing one's utmost. It was unalleviated by a legal minimum. And when we read the earliest verses of the Quran, we are conscious of an elite surrounding the Prophet, whose lives were utterly dedicated to God, and whose intensity of worship clearly went far beyond the possibility of all but a few. So that when the religion began to spread, the revelation made the demands less rigorous. At the beginning, we do not have exact dates, but the Prophet was in Mecca for about 12 years before he went to Medina. We have the date 622 is the date of the Hijra, that is when the Prophet himself went to Medina, and that is the year 1 in the Anno Hegiri, A-H, we call the Latin Anno Hegiri, the year of the Hijra. Is the first year of Islam, 622 AD. But about 12 years before that came the first revelation of the Quran in Mecca to the Prophet. Now, in the beginning of Islam, there was a certain advantage which has never existed since that time. That is a total absence of hypocrisy. Because there was no advantage, to say the least, in being a Muslim. It was disadvantageous from a worldly point of view, and in highly dangerous, so that there were no there was nobody who pretended to be a Muslim. But then 12 or 13 years later, when the Prophet moved to Medina and became very quickly the ruler of Medina, there began to be a considerable worldly advantage in being a Muslim. So then the danger of hypocrisy began. And that is inevitably what has happened more and more since. Spiritual men and women gradually became more and more of a minority. And it is very significant that a very early Meccan revelation, the Surat Al-Muzammal, meaning addressing the Prophet, you who are wrapped up, because the Prophet was, although he wanted to receive revelations, it was such a tremendous experience that he was frightened. There's a verse of the Quran which tells us, if we sent down this Quran upon a mountain, it would break in pieces. And that gives us some idea of what it must have been like for the prophet to receive, who was more than a mountain, much, much more than a mountain. His soul was much more modern. But nonetheless, it was a very awe-inspiring experience, to say the least. And he wrapped himself, he told his wife to put clothes on top of him at night. Sometimes he felt afraid. Now, this revelation begins, arise, to the prophet, telling him to arise and to keep vigil all the night, save a little, and follow. This is followed by other rigorous orders. But in the Medina period, a final verse was added to this surah, making the demands much less rigorous, because the demands of Sufism, which these first Muslims were clearly Sufis without the name Sufi, they were bent on doing all that was physically possible. They were totally given to God, and they were capable of carrying out the instructions such as keep vigil all the night, save a little, half of it, or more, or less, and so on. Whereas this final verse, which was revealed in Medina, says that God does not wish to ask of man too much, and do what is easy for you, what you can do with ease, and so on. This final verse was added. But nonetheless, despite that addition of the final verse in the Surah Muzammil, the Quran continues throughout its revelation to address the small group of Sufis who nonetheless continue to exist until the present day. And there are many verses in the Quran which go over the heads of the average Muslim, of the vast majority of Muslims. What, for example, is thought by people of a verse? It is not the eyesights which are blind, but it is the hearts in the breasts which are blind. The average Muslim, the vast majority of Muslims, they don't know what that means. For them, the heart is just the center of the human body, towards which blood flows, which keeps the body alive. But in the Quran, when in the verse like this, it is not the eyesights which are blind, but the hearts in the breasts which are blind, al-qulub. It is referring to what is called in Sufism the eye of the heart, Ayn al-Qalb. That is the center, not of the body, but the center of the soul. The Prophet himself said that He spoke of being awake like the other prophets before him. That is, that his eye, the heart, the eye of his heart was open. And that is something which the eye, well, the average person doesn't, the average Muslim doesn't know anything about. Now, when we read the Quran, when we come to the phrase in Arabic, "Akthar an-nas," most people, that is, most Muslims, so-called, we know that something bad is coming. There is no mention of the word Sufi in the Quran. Of course, the name didn't exist. But when we know the nearest Quranic equivalent to Sufism is the phrase Ulul al-Bab, those who have a kernel, literally speaking, the kernel being the heart. It is those, it is the kernel, lub, which is referred to in this verse, La ta'amal absaru, walakin ta'amal qulub alati fi sudur. It is not the eyesights which are blind, but it is the hearts and the breasts which are blind. The heart is the kernel referred to by in Ulul al-Bab, the phrase. When that those words come in the Quran, we know that it's going to be followed by something good. And throughout the Quran, throughout the revelation of the Quran, down to the end, there are many verses which pass over the heads of the majority of Muslims, and which are made for the Sufis, clearly themselves. Now, I will go on. I mustn't spend too long talking about this, but I will just go on to say a few words about Sufi doctrine and I recounted in my book on an Algerian sheikh, a great Algerian Sufi sheikh. The book itself is called A Sufi Saint of the 20th Century. He lived at the beginning of the last century, that is in the 1900s. And he would say sometimes to his disciples, so I read, I never encountered him myself, but I encountered one of his successors, or his successor. But he would say sometimes to some of his disciples, I sometimes wish you had never learned the words La ilaha illallah, because you don't understand the meaning of La ilaha illallah means, because the name, the word ilaha includes all the divine names. The word Allah includes all the divine names. La ilaha illallah means also La haqqa illallah. There is no reality but God. The Sufis say, with regard to their doctrine, they quote the saying of the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, they quote his saying, God was, and there was nothing with him. And the Sufis add, in respect of their doctrine, he is now even as he was. They do that with a certain cunning. They know that they are safe from persecution if they express themselves in that way, because the average faqih, that is a representative of the Islamic doctrine, will not dare to suggest that God changes, that God is subject to change. They say he is now even as he was. That is, he is, and there is nothing with him. The question of union does not exist, union with God does not exist in Sufism, despite the accusations of people about that, because one plus one equals two. One plus naught equals one. And that is the doctrine of Sufism. One must become nothing in order to be with God. And that nothingness is expressed by the word fakr, poverty. That is why Sufis among themselves, they don't speak of Sufis, they speak of the fukara. Are all the fukara here, for example? That is the poor. Spiritual poverty, fakr, in its highest sense, means nothingness. The word fana, extinction, is used very much in Sufism. Extinction. That means extinction of the individual soul. The soul becomes nothing in order that it may enter the divine presence, because only nothing can enter the divine presence. And this is what really distinguishes the Sufis from the rest of the community. Of course, not every Sufi, I'm not claiming that every Sufi lives up to what Sufism means. And in fact, there's necessarily been a degeneration in Sufism, as in other aspects of Islam. But there is another aspect of Sufism about which I would like to say something before we finish. What is the time?
20 to 2.
Yes. Well, I've gone.
It's okay. It's great. But
you said 3/4 of an hour.
Take as long as you like.
I will go on. In any case, I will just mention this point of this aspect of Sufism. As you know, the world is made in the image of God. There is a hadith, it is sometimes usually accepted by the Sufis as a hadith Qudsi, that is where God speaks in the first person on the tongue of the Prophet. But it is recognized as a truth generally in Islam, expressing a truth and put into the words of God. I was a hidden treasure and I loved to be known, and so I created the world. And sometimes it said, and so I created man. But man is a world in himself. He is the little world in Islamic, in Sufi language. Al-Kawn al-Kabir is the macrocosm in English, a Greek word, but in English it's the macrocosm, is the outer world. The microcosm, Al-Kawn al-Sarir, is the little world of man. And sometimes this analogy, all religions teach that man was created in the image of God. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, for example, are identical in that doctrine. Now, sometimes there is therefore an analogy between man and God. Man, God, and man made in his image. But sometimes the analogy is inverted. God is, after all, the first of all things. But man was created the last of all things. When everything else, he was created on the sixth day after everything else. Another example of inverse analogy is that in God, the divine beauty is more of a secret than the divine goodness. The divine beauty is more of a secret than the divine goodness. Whereas in man, beauty is outward, goodness is inward. Now, sacred art is only concerned with one thing, that is the divine beauty, which is the secret. And therefore, sacred art requires, as its artists, those people who are innermost in the community, who have and who can see inwards more than other people, and those are precisely the Sufis. It has been calculated, for example, now, what are the two great sacred arts of Islam, one might say? What springs first of all to mind is architecture and calligraphy. Those are the two of the greatest sacred arts in Islam, and it has been calculated that nearly all the builders of mosques were Sufis. And it has been also calculated that 80% of the great calligraphers, of the great Quran calligraphers who wrote manuscripts of the Quran, were Sufis. That is another aspect. It's the same thing in every other religion. You always have the what are called the mystics. In Christianity, most of the manuscripts, most of the churches were built by people who had some kind of equivalent to the Sufis. And in the Middle Ages of Christianity, most of the manuscripts, the beautiful manuscripts, were written in the monasteries and the convents of Christianity. It's the same with other religions, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, and in Taoism, the Far Eastern. Now, I haven't time to say much more, but I would like to read you the end of, an English translation of the wine song of Ibn al-Farid. Ibn al-Farid lived in the to the end of the Middle Ages in Egypt, and he was considered by some people to be the greatest of Arab poets. And one of his poems is called Al-Khamriya. It is that wine signifies God, the divine presence. Of course, wine is forbidden to Muslims, but things forbidden to Muslims are not at the same level. We are not promised the meat of pigs in paradise, which is forbidden. We are promised wine in paradise. And that's the difference between the two. And this is what Ibn al-Farid, how he ends his poem. The tavern where the wine is to be found means the Zawiya, that is the place where the Sufis gathered together, because Ibn al-Farid was a great Sufi. His tomb is outside Cairo, near the eastern desert, and it is considered as one of the seven holiest places in Egypt to be visited, the tomb of Ibn al-Farid. I will just read you these lines. Seek it then in the tavern, this is the wine, bid it unveil, that is, let the cobwebs be taken off the vessel which holds the wine, bid it unveil to strains of music, they offset its worth. For wine and care dwelt never in one place, even as woe with music cannot dwell. Be drunk 1 hour with it, and thou shalt see time's whole age as thy slave at thy command. He hath not lived here who hath sober lived, and he who dieth not drunk hath missed the mark. With tears then let him mourn himself, whose life hath passed, and he no share of it hath had. Well, let me end here my talk, because there is no more time.